Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, World War II ended over 70 years ago. We've had many since then, but it was, as Archie Bunker used to call it, the big one. You might say it was the last good war, right? And it was certainly the last one that the whole nation participated in and sacrificed for. And for that reason, it's always been portrayed in a positive light in books and movies. Starting in the 1990s in particular, there was a spate of intense remembering of the war in movies such as Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers and Schindler's List, as well as books like Tom Brokaw's The Greatest Generation. And even with the movies that focus on the much more recent wars in the Middle East, movies today have continued to kind of romanticize World War II. The Monuments Men and Inglourious Basterds come to mind. But there's one aspect of World War II that American popular culture shies away from, and that's the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with atomic bombs in August 1945. People who understood the dynamics of the war in the Pacific know that the alternative would have been for us to invade the Japanese mainland, resulting in far more deaths of Japanese civilians as well as tens of thousands of soldiers on both sides. So it's justified in that way, but somehow it was the Holocaust-like totality of the instant obliteration of two cities that shocked the world and us, and still does today, and leads us to almost ignore this last episode of the war. Those atomic weapons may have appeared out of thin air over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but they didn't appear out of thin air in the American arsenal. They were conceived in university physics departments and constructed in a huge and secret effort called the Manhattan Project, which was located in a secret city built on former farmland in East Tennessee south of Knoxville, a city named Oak Ridge. My guest has written a book called Ignored Heroes of World War II, The Manhattan Project Workers of Oak Ridge, Tennessee. His aim is to bring the tens of thousands of people who worked on the Manhattan Project out of the shadows of history and accord them their share of recognition and appreciation for the vital contribution they made to the war effort. His name is Richard Cook. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you on. Why don't you just start by giving us an overview of the background that was driving our rush to develop nuclear weapons in World War II?
Well, certainly there was only one reason, and that's that Hitler also had an atomic weapons program, and that was what drove the Manhattan Project. If Germany had not started their program, we would not have started ours. And the people that knew about the German program, because of course it was top secret, knew that if he got the weapon first, that London would be gone, millions of people would die, and Europe would fall to Germany, and that just could not happen.
Yeah, so that was a pretty strong driver. The whole thing was, you know, as you say, extremely secret. How was the location for Oak Ridge chosen, just to start with here?
There were a lot of considerations. They wanted a sparsely populated area because they didn't want to have to displace 100,000 people because that would draw too much attention. They needed a reliable water source, and more important than anything, they needed massive amounts of electricity, which TVA could provide through their hydroelectric dams.
How was the land acquired? Was it just eminent domain, or did they just kind of come in and force people out? I mean, what was the process like briefly?
It was condemnation, and they displaced 500 farmers, basically. It was not pretty. People came home from work one day, and they would have a single piece of paper on their front door saying, you have 3 weeks to get out.
Well, and these would be people who, for the most part, I would imagine, living in kind of outback Tennessee, were people who'd been there for generations, you know, 100 years or whatever, had owned this farm.
Yes, I mean, it was their own little Garden of Eden, and it provided everything for them, everything. And the government just came along and said, you're gone. Now, they did compensate them, but not nearly enough to go buy other land. Many of them bought other farmland, but also many of them ended up working at the industrial plants.
Well, they kind of had to, because I would imagine that was their only option at that point. Kind of the nuclear option had been exercised on them. Golly, so like suddenly evicted from your farm. I mean, they had farm animals and equipment and buildings, and as you say, they probably weren't compensated well at all. And then if you're going to go try to buy land somewhere else, I would imagine suddenly the price of land outside that zone that was being bought up by the government was skyrocketing, right?
Exactly. And you said something very smart in your introduction, and that's that we romanticize World War II. And the very first chapter in my book is called Eviction. And that's because I don't want people to romanticize what happened here. There were social costs for what happened. Evicting these farmers was a huge price for them to pay.
You said a lot of them went to work for the Oak Ridge, the Manhattan Project, but those who didn't, I mean, were they just kind of in a diaspora and just wandered out across the countryside, or were they sleeping in caves, or what was going on with a lot of those people?
It seems like most of them ended up at the plants, or they ended up in Knoxville, which is about 20 miles away. But for all of them, they were bitter till the end of their lives, and I don't think that was unjustified either. Mm. They were treated poorly.
How about other local inhabitants who weren't displaced? How did they view the Oak Ridge newcomers, who I guess probably, you know, just poured in to this area from all parts of the country?
The technical people came from all over the country, but as with any big project, there were two phases. There was the construction phase, and then there was the operational phase. And during the construction phase, this was good employment for tens of thousands of local people. I mean, they were paying 65, 75 cents an hour, which was a great wage at that time. And this was coming out of the Great Depression, where there were no jobs, not just bad jobs, there were no jobs.
Right. We're talking with Richard Cook, who's the author of a book called Ignored Heroes of World War II, The Manhattan Project Workers of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, about the secret and very large project that suddenly blossomed in farmland in East Tennessee to build Oak Ridge, Tennessee, to build the facilities it required to build the atomic bomb under the Manhattan Project. Tell us about the town and the facilities, Richard. They're two different things, right? But the town and then all the plant facilities that were attached to it.
Well, there were three main industrial sites, and the entire purpose of this community was to make fuel for this new atomic weapon. They did not build the bomb in Oak Ridge. That was done in Los Alamos, New Mexico. But the fuel was generated here. And so there were three main industrial sites where they were doing that, and they were using three different methods to enrich the uranium. And they were using three different methods because they didn't know which one was going to be successful. So they started out with all three, figuring that one would be dominant or be best, and they would pick that process. As it ended up, they used all three. This was a new fuel for a new weapon. They didn't know how it was going to react, and they were worried about industrial accidents. So the workers lived many miles from the plants, and they were ferried in and out on a bus system. So the housing was many miles from the industrial plants. And in fact, the ninth largest bus system in the country was created to ferry these people back and forth.
Just briefly, what were they producing? Were they producing enriched uranium? It wasn't plutonium, right?
Right. It was uranium only. Mm. And this was a new process. They didn't know how it was going to work. And in many instances, they were building these industrial sites before they even knew what kind of equipment was going to go into it. And so they had to be very creative about how they built these sites. And as I said, the site was picked because they had a lot of availability to hydroelectric power. And Oak Ridge consumed 10% more electricity than New York City during World War II, although it only had 1% of the population of New York City.
I thought it was funny, in the frontispiece to your book, which is kind of a coffee table-sized book with lots and lots of photographs in it, and we'll get to that in a little while, but a very attractive book. In the front page of it, President Roosevelt called in the then-senator from Tennessee, who was the head of what the Appropriations Committee may be, and said, "Gee, I'm going to have to spend $1 billion real fast to get this project done. Can you handle that," meaning in an appropriation sense? And he said, "Yes, sir, we can. Where in Tennessee would you like it to be positioned?"
Exactly. Exactly. All things being equal, the decision to place it here was a political decision. And FDR was totally fine with that.
Yeah, they wanted someplace away from the coast so it couldn't be attacked by submarine, and away from populated centers, as you said, so that you could try to maintain the secrecy. So let's talk about the town itself, which was a unique company town, probably never before seen in America, and maybe never since, really, quite like that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole strata of housing. There was housing out around the construction sites where they were building the industrial plants, because then they didn't have to worry about the issue of getting workers back and forth. And those facilities were pretty crude, for the most part, for the construction workers. But they had a whole hybrid of housing options. They had trailers. They had prefab houses that could be brought in on trucks and just set on a foundation. And then they had dorms, and then they had apartments. And then for the elites in the community, they did have actual houses.
Yeah, there were things that you called hutments. I mean, let's kind of work up from the bottom up. There was a stratification of workers by skill and by race and by gender, so that people were subdivided in various categories. What was the lowest form of housing? Were you living in a pup tent?
Yeah, well, Well, no, you were living in a hut, which was about a 10 by 10 square building with a roof on it and a coal-burning stove inside for the wintertime, but no running water. No, I don't think they had electricity. It was a very crude form of living, and the blacks were segregated, which was something that was of the South of that time. But in this place, they were segregated by gender. The men were kept in one area, the women were kept in another. And even if you were married, you couldn't live with your spouse. You lived in these segregated camps that were called pens. Pens are where you keep livestock.
So were they more than one person per hutment?
There were four or five people per hut. And in the women's pen area, the guards came through and they had a bed check every night to make sure that people weren't out gallivanting around the country.
Doing what people do with their spouses and girlfriends and boyfriends. I mean, it sounds, honestly, it reminds you, the description sounds like Auschwitz or something. I mean, it sounds that bad, but I don't think the conditions were anything like that at all, but the living conditions were pretty bare, pretty
Well,
Spartan.
When you read these interviews of the black people who came here during the war, it's amazing how there's so little rancor from them about their housing situation. They'll say, you know, outside of housing, we were in the South, and there was nothing different about how we were treated. And they said the housing was substandard, but we were getting paid very good money, and we were sending money back home, and so they put up with it.
Yeah, as you say, it was kind of the tail end of the Depression, so a lot of people were real glad to have the work. They were also building some, let's call them community facilities, too. There were facilities for entertainment and food and medical services. Just briefly, what were those like, and could everybody have access to them kind of equally, or what?
They did have access to them equally. Your housing was subsidized. Your food was subsidized to a certain degree. The government wasn't trying to make money off these workers. They were just trying to entice them to stay because the vast majority of them came to Oak Ridge voluntarily, and that meant they could leave voluntarily too. So they pampered the workers outside of the workplace. And so there were theaters, there was a symphony orchestra, there were athletic leagues. It was a very vibrant, hopping town during World War II.
Was there a big fence around the whole thing?
You know, that's in dispute. In the early days after the war, they claimed that the whole place was fenced in, and much of it was. Certainly the industrial sites were. There's some question about whether there was fencing around the housing areas. I've gotten different answers to that.
It's amazing that such a large complex could, I mean, how many acres was it?
60,000 acres.
I mean, that's huge. You know, that's a good-sized chunk of a county. So how is such a large complex built in secret? I can imagine that everyone in the region must have had at least some idea what was going on, if not why. Was that the case? I mean, it was like everybody knew there was this big thing building out there?
Well, that was it. I mean, it was on a need-to-know basis. And so people knew something big was going on, but they just simply didn't know what it was. And I should mention that on this need-to-know basis, Vice President Harry Truman did not know about the Manhattan Project.
Wow.
After FDR died, the Secretary of War came to him a couple hours later and says, I need to meet with you and tell you about this project we're doing. So he didn't find out about it until 4 or 5 days after he became president.
That's extreme need to know. So how was secrecy maintained among these tens of thousands of workers who were, you know, just high school dropouts? I mean, just simple people with a bare skill. How did they enforce secrecy?
You know, they did it through a lot of what you would call employee orientations, where you got hired, and 60% of the time was spent talking about how you can't talk about your work. There was a level of intimidation. There was also this whole message of, if you talk about this project, your sons and daughters are going to die in war. They laid it right on them.
Yeah, so the kind of the carrot was patriotism and the job itself, and then the stick was the threat of punishment. I mean, were they threatened with jail and that kind of thing if they were found talking about it?
Yes. And this wasn't a one-shot deal. I mean, they had meetings, ongoing meetings about secrecy. And for example, at work, if you worked at one of the industrial sites and you were a maintenance guy, you wore a blue jumpsuit. And as part of the protocol, you could only talk to people who had blue jumpsuits on. If you went and talked to somebody that had a red jumpsuit on, that person would say, what the hell are you doing?
Wow.
Why are you talking to me?
Huh. I think in your book, they also had little different pins that had different numbers on them, and you could only talk to people of that number or higher or lower or whatever.
I mean, if you had the lowest security clearance, which was a 1, You could only talk to a guy in a blue jumpsuit who also had a one. You couldn't talk to a two or a three.
And there were also these big billboards that were all very Big Brotherish. These are pictures in your book, you know, very intense messages of basically zip, you know, loose lips sink ships kind of thing like that.
Constantly. And I should also tell you that for people that don't know the history of World War II, the loss of American life during World War II would equal a 9/11 attack every 5 days for 3.5 years.
It was a big nationwide kind of all-out effort for sure. And these people knew they were participating in that. I mean, they knew it was a war effort project they were on. They just had no idea, except for very few people at the top, what it was, you know. So we're talking again with Richard Cook, who is the author of a book, Ignored Heroes of World War II, and it's about the Manhattan Project workers in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and the way they lived and the work they did. So what kinds of occupations, I mean, there were many, but what were the predominant occupations, Richard, of people who were working at Oak Ridge?
Well, I mean, the technical staff, the engineers and the scientists who were doing all the applied science to try to get this uranium for this weapon. But then you just had the stratification of a major town. It was the fifth largest city in the state of Tennessee when it was completed and had 75,000 people. So you needed teachers. You needed barber shops. You needed grocery stores. So there was all that infrastructure of just running a town. But certainly the elites in the town were the engineers and the scientists who were driving the work at these industrial sites.
You know, there are pictures in your book of long banks of machinery with young women sitting every 10 feet or so in front of a panel of dials and that kind of thing. What were they doing?
Well, they were enriching uranium, but of course they didn't know that. The famous photographs are what they call the Calutron girls. And the Calutrons were an electric magnetic process to try to enrich uranium. And there were about 1,000 of those machines, and they ran 24/7. So these girls were trained to keep these needles within a certain range on a meter by turning these dials. And I should say the scientists kind of got in a twit because the Calutron girls were barely out of high school. Most of them were from farms. And the scientists just thought they weren't doing a very good job. So they had a competition between the scientists and the Calutron girls, and the scientists lost.
They were willing to pay attention longer and more closely. It's funny.
They wouldn't mess with it. Yeah. They would set it and leave it alone, and the scientists kept tweaking it.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, I mean, today, that's the kind of thing, obviously, it would be automated, but, you know, then you had somebody standing and staring, watching at a dial. At the same time, you had people working telephone switchboards back then, too, you know, so it kind of looks like that visually, in a way. But, well, you know, talking about the girls there, the Calutron girls, what were the demographics of the workers? In particular, what was the, let's call it the girl-boy ratio?
It was about 10 to 1.
10 to 1
so,
women?
So the guys thought they had died and gone to dating heaven.
Wow.
Because there were women everywhere. But that was a dynamic that was happening nationally because, of course, Rosie the Riveter was this symbol of women that got into the workplace because of the war.
So were a lot of the men there 4F? How were they not in the war?
Well, boy, that's a big story, too. The technical people got a buy because they were needed for a project of national importance in the United States. And so there was a lot of bitterness among people about these guys that were getting buys, not going to the front lines. And when these people went to Knoxville for entertainment, they were free to leave the secret colony and go to Knoxville. Occasionally, they were confronted by women who said, "You look like you're okay to me. Why aren't you off fighting with my father?"
Or my son. So instead, they're under the yum-yum tree back there with 10 women for every man. Largely, the women were young, single girls, you know, in their, what, early 20s or their 20s or so.
Yeah, right.
That must
well,
have been.
The average age in Oak Ridge was 27.
Wow. What was day-to-day life like there? Was it all work and no play, or, you know, was there plenty of opportunity for recreation?
There was a lot of opportunity for recreation because, here again, they worked hard, and they worked 6 days a week, sometimes seven. But they were worried, the officials were worried these people were going to leave, and so they were catered to, and there were parties, and there were dances, and there were athletic leagues. So it was a very fun place to be, and people will tell you it was the most exciting time of their lives.
I can picture the dances with 1,000 women on one side and 100 men on the other.
Right.
and many of them nerdy guys who had never had a girlfriend or whatever.
Right. And you know, for the technical people, many of them were away from home for the first time, and they were in the middle of nowhere working on who knows what. So there was a whole aura of mystery around this whole thing, which I think just added to the excitement.
I mean, was there a feeling, there must have been a feeling of a shared mission, even if they didn't know what the mission was, right?
Sure, and one of the difficult things for people today to understand is because we were in this national crisis, when you read these interviews, there's this great faith in large institutions to do the right thing for the right reasons. And when you read these interviews and see people making comments like that, today it seems almost laughably naive.
But at the time, it was an all-out national effort. I mean, it was kind of like the feeling after 9/11 for a couple of weeks. It was that kind of a feeling of everybody coalescing into one shared, even more so because there was a clear mission there, you know.
It's amazing you bring that up because I heard that a lot from the locals after 9/11.
Was there much governmental control of their off-duty behavior when they went into Knoxville? Were they tagged along after by minders, or were they pretty much free to do whatever they could as long as they obeyed the very much spoken rule of don't talk about it?
They pretty much left them alone. I think the officials basically thought, within the confines of security and secrecy, we're going to give them as much freedom as we can. And so, no, they weren't followed.
So some of these girls were allowed to find a boyfriend in Knoxville, maybe, as long as they minded their P's and Q's, I hope.
Yes.
Well, you know, the gigantic secrecy of the project is part of the reason for its obscurity in our minds in history, right? It's, you know, part of the reason that it's not as well known as D-Day, for example, and that kind of thing. So how did you go about collecting material for your book? Was it hard to do?
You know, I was just incredibly lucky. There's a place called the Center for Oak Ridge Oral Histories, and they've done 450 interviews over the last 20 years or so. And all of those interviews are available online. And then there was this official photographer, Ed Westcott, and cameras were banned in Oak Ridge for security reasons. So this official photographer is the only one that had the opportunity to create this visual record. And about 1,500 of his photographs are available online. And I'm not a high-tech person, but I will tell you, I did this entire book on my laptop in my living room.
You didn't have to go to the National Archives because there wasn't much there.
Almost all of Ed Westcott's work is at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, and in Atlanta, Georgia. But they have slowly been posting those things online, and he was a government employee, so it's public domain material.
A lot of them are really striking photographs. You mentioned to me that he's still alive.
95 years old.
Well, I'm glad they did hire someone to take a documentary photographic record of it. Otherwise, it'd be nothing. And so your, as I mentioned, kind of a coffee table format book is full of his photographs, which are very clear and kind of evocative of the way life was in the place. It's not just formal governmental photographs. It's kind of everyday life, day in the life type of pictures, a lot of it. In your book, much of the bulk of your book is really anecdotes of people who did, give interviews, whether to you or other people, I don't know. But do you have a couple of anecdotes that are kind of brief that you can read to us just to give us a flavor of that?
Sure. Well, the first one is from Rabbit Yearwood, and it says, "It's interesting to know the year before the secret of Oak Ridge was let out with the bombing of Hiroshima, when it became worldwide, Rand McNally's last map of the United States before that event had Oak Ridge on it with a population of 75 people. There were 75,000. And the eviction process from John Rice Irwin. We came home from Nash Copeland's store one day, and we'd been seeing the activities and hearing about the speculation about what was going on. And I remember we came up to our front door with my mother and dad and my brother, and there was a piece of paper attached to the screen door flapping in the wind. I was 11 at the time, I guess. I didn't know what it said, but by the expression on my dad's face and my mother's, I knew there was something really bad."
You know, so in your book, there are dozens and dozens of these little stories from people that are just quotes of simple folk, you know, who worked there. And it's, I can't read all that. What we're talking about here is really just the background to the story. But I'd urge people to get your book, again, called Ignored Heroes of World War II by Richard Cook, and just read the little, you know, excerpts of stories about people's experience there in Oak Ridge during and immediately after the war. You know, we're getting kind of toward the end of the show here, Richard, but obviously there's a near taboo that surrounds the actual bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How many people died in those two cities, both immediately and then afterwards, of radiation poisoning?
In Nagasaki, it was 30 to 50,000 people immediately, and then another 30 to 50,000 long-term. In Hiroshima, it was 60 to 80,000 in the first couple of days, and then 60 to 80,000 long-term. So around 250,000 total.
Yeah, around a quarter million people, which is a whole lot of people. But, I mean, when you think about it cold-bloodedly, what's paradoxical is that the same feeling of aversion that we have kind of toward those two awful events doesn't attach to other large-scale Allied attacks on civilian populations, such as the firebombing of Tokyo, where I think a lot more people were killed than in either one of those nuclear bombings, or of Dresden and Hamburg in Germany, where basically they just carpeted the whole city with incendiary bombs and tens of thousands of civilians were killed in Europe there. You know, we got the idea you mentioned of Rosie the Riveter, who worked on B-24 bombers. And then in your book, the cover photo is Wendy the Welder, you call her, who is working in Oak Ridge. And nobody's ever seen that photo. She's working on, you know, processing uranium for the bomb. So they're kind of two women who are working on the home front to support the war effort. And yet the reaction to the two is so totally different that one's very well known and lauded and the other is totally unknown. So just briefly, why do you think that is, that big difference?
I think we have a stigma about the bombings, which I think is kind of unfair. For the last 50 years, the international community every August says you should be ashamed of what you did. Now, I don't think we should be proud, but I think there's something between shame and pride, and my book is an attempt to kind of move the needle back to the middle.
It's kind of like a lot of things. It's what I think of as a necessary evil, right? So it's you kind of take your pick. You know, there was one evil to do that, and the other evil was to invade the island and slaughter many more people and have tens of thousands more American boys killed. So, you know, take your pick. But we did that, and luckily it hasn't happened since, although there have been times when the world's been on a cliffhanger whether it was going to happen again. So I'm just wondering about Oak Ridge National Laboratory is there in Oak Ridge today, and that's, you know, it's a big government facility. Are the residents around that area and in Knoxville very aware of the past of what went on during World War II? Are they more aware and maybe more positive about it than the rest of the country is?
Just barely. Uh-huh. It's amazing. It seems to be a factor of age. If you're under the age of 50, you're just woefully ignorant of what happened during World War II and what happened here. If you're over 50, you had a grandfather or a father who was in the war, so you have some kind of personal connection to the story.
Of course, World War II now is like World War I was to someone like me, or even earlier, War of 1812 or something, I don't know.
Right. Anyway.
Well, Richard Cook, I appreciate you being on, and good luck in your effort to bring more attention to the Manhattan Project workers, who really do deserve it. They worked in secrecy to do something that basically ended the war much sooner than it otherwise would have ended. And again, the book is Ignored Heroes of World War II, The Manhattan Project Workers of Oak Ridge, Tennessee. You can buy the book at Richard's website, which is ignoredheroes.com, easy to remember, ignoredheroes.com, or at Amazon. And he was telling me he makes no money at all if you buy it from Amazon, but he actually prefer you to buy it from ignoredheroes.com, so I would urge you to do that too if you want to take a look at the book. It's a really nice book. Richard, thank you so much for being on with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And as always, thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.